Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host this afternoon. Today's program is a little out of the ordinary. I have assembled an awesome and very diverse panel of experts, and we want to talk about the war on drugs, a war that in many ways does not seem to be easy to win. Joining us today are award-winning journalist and the news and programming director for the Sky 97.3 out of Gainesville, Florida, TJ Hart. TJ, how good to hear you.
Thank you, sir. It's great to be heard at this point.
Also from Florida, we have best-selling author Armando Aldazabal. He has two novels in print, Cocaine Memoirs and What You Are Turning Me Into. Although they are both works of fiction, they pull heavily on his real-life experiences with family and friends dealing with drugs. Armando, great that you could join us today.
Well, it was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
From the wilds of Texas, we have David Allen Johnson. I have a feeling that David is going to be a key player this afternoon. He is an author. He has two books currently in print, a novel, Asgard, which is set in Africa, and a non-fiction work, How to Get a Job in the War on Terror. David does actually have a day job, and it's a somewhat unusual one. He is a private military contractor, and since 1988 has been heavily involved in both the War on Terror and the War on Drugs. Dave, it is great to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
From Las Vegas, we have author and crime writer Denny Griffin. Denny is a deep thinker and always poses the very, very best questions. Denny, it is delightful to have you on the show.
And delightful to be with you and the other panelists. Thanks a lot.
And last, but by no means least, we have Andrew DiDonato. Andrew was a member of the Gambino crime family, and one of his missions was to establish a drug corridor originating in Mexico, going through San Diego, Las Vegas, and on to New York. He was in the Witness Protection Program for a while, and also spent some time behind bars. He is a reformed character and a very nice man. Andrew, it is a pleasure to talk to you again.
You too, Simon. Thank you very much for having me.
Our phone lines are open, and our switchboard number is area code 646-378-1120, and we welcome your questions and comments. Also, you're welcome to ask them in our chat room. So, on with the program. As I see it, there is really not one drug war, but two. Prescription drugs and street drugs. TJ, I want to start with you. Florida seems to have become the Southeast's pharmacy. What the hell is going on down there?
A combination of things. We do have these things called pill mills. We also have a lot of military bases, and I'll get into that here in a little bit because on its face it sounds a bit disingenuous. And also the big culprit appears to be pain clinics where people are being treated for a variety of aches and pains, primarily a good thought because we have a great deal of senior citizens in our Sunshine State, and we love our seasoned citizens, but with older age comes a lot of pain. And that's primarily where these things sprung up. And after that, it became a bit of a nice little side business. If you could perhaps be convinced to write script or somehow get something that looks like an official script out of one of these pain clinics, and be well on your way to getting some oxycodone, hydrocodone, and substances like Vicodin and things like that, prescription meds. Now, one thing that is happening on a almost, three or four times a day that we have to report on, just here in my little spot in Florida, which is Gainesville, Ocala, Palatka, Cedar Key, and the areas of that nature, is that drugstores are getting hit. They're getting hit by people who are addicted to the substance, and they don't want money. They simply want the pills. They don't want to hurt anybody, although they'll come in often armed. They just want the bloody pills, and these get circulated as a way of making money, but also feeding the addiction primarily, and then what's left, trying to pay off some drug debts and buy some more drugs. So it's crazy. It's very, very crazy with the Army installations and the Navy installations and things like that. We're hearing stories of people who are getting their scripts from the VAs or from the different installations on base, and what happens is that they get them filled, but they still have the script, and they're going out double-dipping, and they're taking the script with them, and they're going to a Walgreens or a CVS or the pharmacy of your choice, and they're getting pretty much double loads of what was legally prescribed to them. So that's where it stands in Florida. It's a mess.
But, you know, I've heard this story about the double dipping before, and it confuses me. I mean, the VA must run a very strange system if they give the prescription slip back to the patient.
Well, I can't speak for it. I can only tell you that this has happened in a few cases that I know of. I don't think it's what you call their regular process. I believe that someone is pretty much on the take during these scenarios. But, that's the government for you. So,
man, oh, man.
Okay. I could go into another tangent there, but I won't because I'm only reporting facts.
Okay. Armando, you're in Florida in the heart of where this action is going on. I know that currently you live up in the northern part, but I believe you grew up around the Miami area. What's your views on the prescription drug problem?
Well, actually, I grew up in pretty much Orlando, Florida, off of Cayley and Paramore, Westmoreland. So, I mean, I grew up in the heart of pretty much Drug City. And as far as the prescription, the whole thing, from what I've been hearing and gathering around, they're pretty much just like an abortion clinic. I mean, they're open 45 minutes to an hour. You know, pretty much the medicine is gone right away. They ask you beforehand, you know, if you smoke marijuana, you're okay. If you're doing PCP or any other substance, you need to get up and go right now. And from what I hear, the room clears. And right there and then, they prescribe you up to like 330 Oxycontins, 60 Xanax, whatever fourth you want. I mean, all you have to do is pay the price. And if you have insurance, then the price lowers for you.
Wow.
It's quite a system. It really is. It started out with the best of intentions, but it is basically you're going to McDonald's to get pills, not to disparage the McDonald's.
Whoa. And you know, unless I'm very much mistaken, the person writing the prescription has spent 7 years in medical school learning the trade.
Yeah, school of pharmacology, you bet.
They're making a lot of money from the source that I have from that, you know, pretty much goes there for legitimate reasons. It's like $700 and something just for like 240 oxys and say like 50 Xanax or so forth. I mean, they're getting paid, so they're correct.
Denny, what's the situation like out west? Are prescription drugs a problem in the Las Vegas area?
Yeah, I don't know. Is there any more of a problem than anywhere else? But I'm sure that's also goes on here. No question about it in my mind. However, I just wanted to mention something, and maybe Andrew can comment on this. But I'm originally from New York State, and back in the late 80s and early 90s, I was involved in investigating Medicaid fraud. And one of the things that was going on back then was that the Medicaid mills, as they call them, were buying Medicaid numbers to use to bill and bilk the Medicaid system. And in some cases, they paid cash, but in more often than not, they paid the people for giving up their Medicaid numbers with prescriptions. And that was a real big deal. I remember in Brooklyn, I believe it was Atlantic Avenue perhaps, there was a clinic on every corner or so it seemed, and these people would be lined up from early in the morning to go in there, and they would make their deals and get their scripts. So that was a very much in demand and sought out by people in those times, and maybe Andrew can confirm that if he remembers it.
In the medical field in New York, there's a ton of fraud. There was a ton of fraud throughout the years. I mean, it even happens today. Any person who goes into a doctor's office who has a rapport with their personal doctor, after so many years, if you're this guy's patient, sometimes, more times than not, you could expect, like, doc, I got a pain, my back is bothering me, this is bothering me. Hey, let me write you up a little painkiller, I'll give you something. And it's just as easy as that. Sometimes it doesn't even have to be monetary between the two parties. It's built on relationships. And like Dennis said, a lot of these cases where these numbers was sold for cash or for prescription medication in return, you know, the financial gain is too much to overlook. So whenever you're in a system, whether it be illegal drugs or prescription drugs, whenever you're in a system where there's so much of an influx of money, you're going to have some sort of, you know, fraudulence, you know, because the medical field today, I mean, if you look on television and you see what's getting passed on there, they got a pill for everything now. And you ever see the side effects of these pills? Don't stand up, don't drive on Sunday, don't do this, that. You wonder how these companies get these pills approved by the FDA. But they've made so much money over the years on scams and things like this to profit on that. So I see it this way. I see that something like that would be very, very hard to stop. I don't know, I haven't been to Florida in years, and I can only imagine, but whenever there's money like that, there's too much at stake.
Denny, I want to come back to you. All right, you were involved in investigating Medicaid fraud. How did this fraud work? Where was the money to be made in obtaining a Medicaid number or a patient's number?
Okay, I was primarily involved with the clinical laboratory piece of it. There were a number of ways you could make money. I'll address the clinical laboratory end of it. In the particular scenario, which we called Operation Vampire because it involved blood testing, the clinical laboratories, there were a lot of what we call mom-and-pop operations, family-owned businesses. They were being forced out to a great degree by the mega labs, the Smith Kleins and the MetPaths and the Roaches and so forth. And we had a Pakistani doctor who was here legally in the country, and he had lost his medical license for Medicaid fraud. And what he did, he and his associates, they bought up the mom-and-pop operations, but they didn't officially change ownership because they needed to be licensed to do business. So they would pay the former owners not to come in, only if they needed to sign documents to be there for a state or federal inspection. And what they did, for example, one particular laboratory in Brooklyn, the previous year, I believe it would have been 90 or 91, they had billed Medicaid for, this was the mom-and-pop operation, billed Medicaid for something like $7,000 for the year. After our Pakistani doctor became involved as the hidden owner, their billing went to $1.2
million.
So that was a pretty hefty increase. And someone in social services, apparently their computer flagged that type of an increase. And that and what these people were doing then, they were buying the med. They have to have a Medicaid number to bill to get reimbursed. So they were buying the Medicaid numbers, and these people never gave blood. They were buying blood from street people so they would have something to run through their instruments that when the inspectors came, it would show that testing had actually happened. But it was all bogus, and they even went into a pap smears. This one patient was billed for 120 pap smears a month. And it was really quite an operation. There was a lot of money to be had. And the ironic thing we found is when we had sufficient information, we were able to get the doctor, the defrocked doctor. His father had been part of the operation. His father had gotten out of the country with quite a bit of money just before warrants were issued and had made it back to Pakistan. And after 9/11 of one, I couldn't help but wonder if any of our Medicaid money and so forth helped finance the terrorists. I mean, it's something that sticks in my craw.
Oh my, that really is some creative thinking. Dave Johnson, I know that oxys and roxys don't grow on trees, so they likely are outside of your area of expertise, but Texas is a border state. Do you see a prescription drug problem in Texas?
Not like your other guests are talking about. I live in a more rural area, and our problem is meth. And I don't know if it's because being in a smaller area, the doctors know everybody and everybody knows them. Who knows? Maybe I'm just ignorant of it. But
actually, I was in the Midwest for the first 40-some-odd years of my life, and a lot like Texas, once you get outside the big cities, meth is king, and it's simply because the doctors do know everybody. And these guys who can barely get have a third-grade education are starting to mix these ingredients and chemicals together along with medications, and they're cooking up meth. A lot of times it results in a trailer fire, but they're cooking it up, and suddenly you're seeing somebody who is healthy, and 4 or 5 months down the road, their eyes are all hollowed out, and their face is almost unrecognizable, their skin's terrible, and their teeth are falling out.
Teeth are falling out. That's what we see, yes.
Meth mouth.
Yep.
Meth is insidious. I worked in a large homeless shelter. We had something like 1,100 people sleeping there every night. I was actually involved with the running the computer lab and trying to teach people computer skills. And I would see people day in, day out, and I knew they were only 25, 30 years old, but boy, they looked like they were in their 60s.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, meth is a killer. Things we're talking about street drugs, street drugs seem to fall into two categories. Those originating from natural products such as coca and poppies, and then we've got the lab-made varieties like meth. Much of the natural variety is imported. Not even the fertile grounds of California can supply enough marijuana for the insatiable appetite of the users. David, you're on the leading edge when it comes to fighting the war on drugs outside of the U.S. borders. What are some of the things that are being done to fight drugs at their source?
Well, one of the things that I've been working on is chasing the submarines. The drug guys have hired a pretty famous naval architect out of the Netherlands. And so far we know they've got 63, the State Department doesn't like to call them submarines, they call them self-propelled semi-submersibles. So, you know, somebody's got to think up some name for them. But we chase those quite a bit, both where they're made and on the ocean. And that seems to have really helped their distribution some, where we were able to shut down the go-fasts and the airplanes. We're having a hard time with submarines.
I should point out that David is a pilot. I guess surveillance is your main bag.
Right.
Yeah. So submarines, how it's happening?
Well, right now, you know, it's a constant battle. You know, it's like trying to catch mercury. You keep putting your finger on it, it squirts out somewhere else. And if we can break the code on these submarines, I'm sure they'll think up some other way.
What sort of size vessel are we talking about?
Well, the smallest one we've seen is about 21 feet long, and the longest one was about 66 feet long, and was propelled by two very large diesel engines. It's got a big a snorkel that goes up to suck in the air, you know, and they travel 20, 30 feet under the water. And all we can catch is the snorkel, which made of fiberglass, so it doesn't give off a very good radar return.
My goodness. Andrew, you one of your missions when you were part of the Gambino organization was to set up a supply route that I believe originated in Mexico. So you had to deal with getting goods across the border. I mean, how did you do it?
Well, what happened was the connection that we had the connection. Our connection was out of San Diego. And our connection, of course, was in touch with the drug suppliers from Mexico. And they had told us a few times some of the ploys they would use. I mean, the gentleman who was just speaking would probably know some of the tricks that have been used over the years. But a few times they've even sent shipments out, from what I understand, to get pinched, so they could send something else to divert the interest and get the sellers, send a smaller shipment out to get pinched, so they could funnel it through another way. And what we did was, in San Diego, we had a friend of ours who had a tractor-trailer business. And he used to make runs from California to upstate New York. So what we did was, we used to pay him. He used to load sometimes 200, 300 pounds for us on the truck. And he would take it to Las Vegas. In Las Vegas, we would disassemble it. We would take 100 pounds and we would ship it through either UPS. We had a connection in the U.S. Post Office out in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. So we had a guy in the post office who was like, I would want to say, watch commander or watch shift guy. So we would give him all the pertinent information of, you know, the package number, you know, the tracking number. So he would wait for it in the post office, and when it came, he would pull it to the side for us. So we would send 100 through him, 100 leave on the truck, and send another 100 by another way of mail carrier. We started using UPS. And I can't begin to tell you how many times I was working out of an air-conditioned company that I was, it wasn't mine, I didn't own it, but I was working in conjunction with these people in the air-conditioned business there, and I was like my, however you want to call it, my safe area, my headquarters there, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And it would come in, and UPS would come, and I would sign, and it was like nothing. And I was saying to myself, one day, UPS is going to come deliver it, I'm going to be signing it, and he's going to be an FBI agent, and I'm going to be done. But it never happened. I mean, I couldn't believe it, that it was just so easy. And we did this for months on end. And, of course, it ended for us out in Las Vegas, where the first arrest came down. A friend of mine got caught inside one of these packaging companies, and they caught him with like 200 pounds of marijuana and like 65,000 in cash. So, but the reason why they did wasn't the error from Mexico to San Diego. It had nothing to do with that aspect of it. It just so happened to be that they got somebody who was working behind the counter who picked up an odor, and that's how it was detected. Other than that, this could have went on for a very long time.
What do you think of Dave's statement about them now using submarines to get stuff across the border?
Well, you know, if you look in the paper today and you see what's going on in Mexico right now with the violence and within the drug trade, you know, wherever you see violence at that extent, there's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Because people ain't killing each other for nothing over there. It's all to gain control of either the whole drug trade or for a piece of the drug trade, because there's so much money. And what they're doing with their money, because they have so much of it, is they're able to purchase vessels like that. I had some friends of mine years ago that I was in a federal prison with who were with, you know, organized crime in Russia. And one of these guys became a government witness like myself, and they showed me pictures. He bought a submarine. So yeah. They had the need, and they didn't buy it for drug purposes. They bought it because when the collapse of Russia happened, they were involved with, you know, selling arms across the country, across the United States and in Europe. They were arms dealers. And it just goes to show, if you have the money, there'll be an outlet for it one way or another. And that's the sad part. And that's what makes this gentleman's job on the other end of his phone, that makes his job so hard, is because people can't turn down that kind of money. You got a guy who's just a worker, making maybe $30,000-$40,000 a year, and you get this, one of these big cartel guys come up and put $200,000 in his bank account or give him money on a down low. It just sometimes it's just too much for them to turn away.
Dave, I'm not trying to pry out information that clearly it would be inappropriate for you to share, but where is the prime target? Is it Florida? Is that the main gateway?
No, it's much more like a sieve. You know, you have several places that, just like the other gentleman was talking about, you know, it comes through trucks and it comes in the belly of a military transport airplane. Some will come through the mail and some will come through a ship. It's what we've seen is these going to all these smaller avenues. Now, one exception to that is coming out of Afghanistan. One pilot that I worked for now, was over there, and he went on a hunting trip, made friends with the warlord, and the warlord asked him to shepherd a shipment of 8 ocean-going shipping containers full of unprocessed heroin. Yeah, and had one that was the designated container to get caught, and it had the lowest grade stuff in it, stuff that they normally wouldn't sell.
That's the oldest trick, yeah.
Yeah, and they had already, you know, they had their people in customs. This was going to Europe. That it was going to make them look good, even though they're paid off to let the other stuff go. It makes them look good. They captured an entire shipping container full of this stuff coming out of Afghanistan. And my buddy did not succumb to the temptation, turned it in, and all the shipping containers were caught. And so he had to change continents over that. And now I work with him in South America.
TJ, I mean, you must be just floored by this conversation.
Well, this conversation is terribly enlightening. And when you've got something, that product or a service that someone wants and wants badly, you'll go to no end to provide that substance or that service. And the business model is pretty much there. You have highly addictive products whether it be medications or whether it be, in this case, marijuana, which is just, you know, recreational but highly sought after, or any other, you know, opioids or whatever your thrill might be. But what I'm seeing here is a situation where how do you win? And it almost appears that it's not winnable. But I remember seeing recently an interview with the president of Mexico who said, look, you know, I'm the president of Mexico. I sure as hell don't like my drug guys coming into your nation as much as you don't appreciate me being there too. But if you were to somehow knock off this demand and quit being the best customers of these illegal substances, we wouldn't have, you know, nine-tenths of the problem. But the profit motive is kind of gone, though, once that the illegal substances are made legal and taxed. And I'm seeing a scenario here where, you know, I thank God we got this great panel of very smart guys and folks who have been around this this thing a little bit. This is just an eye-opening thing for me to hear how some of this all goes down. You know, you always have your suspicions, but to hear how the plans go through and how things are set up to make it look one way, and in this case here, where a shipment was supposed to be taken to make somebody look good so that they continue to look the other way. Unbelievable. This thing is blowing me away.
Actually, TJ, we had a similar panel a few weeks ago, and it was equally as eye-opening. In fact, I think it might have been you, Andrew. You
Yes, sir.
I think it might have been you talking about how you know, it's not so much a question of smuggling the drugs across the border. It's more a question of knowing who to bribe.
Yeah, it's like identifying good talent. You got to take care of them.
Well, what happens is you know why we also spoke about the economic aspect of it, where if it stopped completely, how many jobs would be lost if it stopped completely? And I understand that people who have their jobs are really, really good at their jobs, and that, you know, they hold what they're doing highest respect. But in the long run, if have it to stop completely, what would that do, Simon? I mean, we would like to see it because none of us want it near our families. None of us want it near the people we love. We hate to see young kids who get addicted to drugs. We hate to see neighborhoods get torn apart. We hate to see all the bad stuff that comes along with it, like violence, robberies, addiction, prison. You hate to see it. But how many jobs does it give? Because in any economy, any strong economy, you're in your best times, so to speak, in your best times, if you would stop that, there'd be no cash flows.
Right.
You know, and I'm not saying, you know, and believe me, I don't condone it. I don't, you know, I don't think that it's something. Believe me, I'm with everybody on this panel here. I mean, I'm a career criminal. All right, I'll put it out there. But I changed my life, and I would love to be able to help in any way that I possibly can. But I see this on a financial aspect as to, you know, if it stopped completely, what would it do to the economy is what I wonder.
Oh, it would really.
You know, you raise a good point, because there are economies within economies and there are shadow economies, and you're talking about a shadow economy. It's international. It's not one nation doing business internationally. It's a shadow all universal economy.
Denny, you've been very quiet, and I hate it when Denny goes quiet. It means he's got his thinking cap on. What would the economic impact be?
It seems that it could be dramatic. I mentioned the previous show you referred to when this subject came up. After that show, I was thinking, you take your organized crime involvement, for example, where the people who make the money on these drugs want to invest that money in legitimate businesses. So it's not only the people who work directly in drug-related jobs, such as enforcement people or medical people or counselors and that type of thing. What about people who are hired to work in a legitimate business that is created?
You're taking some of those out.
Pardon me?
I said, yeah, you're taking some of those out.
Yeah, so I mean, I think when you really analyze this and think about it, it can have very far-reaching effects. If this problem were to go away overnight, I mean, everybody would rejoice on the one hand, but there would be, I think, maybe some serious economic repercussions over it.
Armando, would you like to weigh in on this question?
Wow. Yeah, I think it was Jay Rankin in the show who said...
Yeah, it was.
Where would we be without drugs? You know, actually, he even pointed it out at me because, you know, my books are very drug-centric, and it is. It's a big part of our economy. But listening to the whole thing with the whole smuggling and the submarines, and it just brings it right back to, you know, the war on drugs and the question of are we winning or not? And in my opinion, we're not going to win the present. The present is already way too contaminated with our past. You know, it's almost like the saying, trying to turn a whore into a housewife. I'm sorry to say that, but, you know, the president is already messed up. So all that we can do to win this war on drugs is educating our children that are not addicted to these drugs, that are not on these drugs. You know, we already have so many addicts, you know, so it's not pretty much the war on drugs. It's the war on addiction. And...
Mm-hmm.
It has to start, you know, with these innocent kids. Once we get these kids established, then I think we can round up the future and maybe perhaps contain the war on drugs. We're never going to win it, but because like Andrew was saying, there's way too much money involved, and when there's money involved in that massive amount, that's it. It's over. You're not going to win it, no matter what you say. You can capture this person, capture that person, but... Like he said, actually, in the last show, it's like Medusa. You cut one head off, boom, the other one's growing right back in.
Dave, I want to throw this next question at you. The war on drugs and the war on terror really dovetail together. Do you want to run with that?
Yeah, the first time I saw that, we... one of my first jobs in this business was installing a low-light camera in the cargo hold of a C-123 that's famous for landing at Mena, Arkansas, if you guys remember that incident. And, well, we captured very, very good video of the president and defense minister of Nicaragua, who were communists at the time, named Daniel Ortega and... can't remember his brother's name, but anyway, we captured very good video of them loading cocaine into that airplane, and that was a Sting airplane. And we ran that video ran on CNN one time, but our Congress was full of people that were sympathetic to the communist movement, and that video was squashed, and the story came out the CIA is running drugs in this airplane. It was a brilliant propaganda move. That was the first time I saw that war being financed with drugs. Later on, I saw the same thing with the FMLN, San Salvador. In working in Colombia, you know, it's not a hardcore like conspiracy. It's like these people trade consultants back and forth. They help each other. Like the FARC in Colombia asked the IRA for a bomb expert in the early 90s. And this bomb expert came over from the IRA, taught them how to make big bombs, which they blew up a lot of buildings all over Colombia with. The same thing with the submarine architect. Right now, Al-Qaeda is, we've hurt Al-Qaeda bad by cutting off their money, tracing their money, forensic accounting. So they've gone to the FARC. They buy cocaine, put it on 727, fly it into the desert in North Africa. That's where I was last year on that program, trying to intercept those 727s. They unload the cocaine, sell it into Europe for two reasons, to weaken Europe and to get the Al-Qaeda operating funds. So there's a definite link in there. It's not anything you can say. It's not a worldwide conspiracy. It's not like these people have a plan to take over the planet. But there is a definite connection.
That is actually a very frightening thought. But isn't the Taliban partially funded through drug money as well?
Oh, that's huge. And everyone knows this is part of the battle. The subtext of the battle in Afghanistan, of course, is we want it because it's a crossroads of trade, and it's going to be, when the oil fields open up north of Afghanistan, it's going to be a huge trail for pipelines. And that's one of the reasons we want it. The Taliban wants it to continue their, they grow most of the opium product in the world there. It's historically been a great place to grow poppies.
Okay. Anyone. Give me
go ahead. The thought of that, Simon, is this. You know, I mean, what he just said, now think about that. We have military in Afghanistan fighting, okay? And there's millions and billions of dollars in this country being funneled to, fight the war on terror every day. But with these, like he said, it's not a worldwide conspiracy. But when you have people conspiring to get a certain action done, it takes away from all the other efforts. So we could keep on fighting the war on terrorism, but is this a war? Is this being run hand in hand with the drugs? Does this mean we can't win that war either? Because there's always going to be something, or there's always going to be a roadblock because of the money that's involved, or to keep things going, so to speak. Like, it's like I think of cancer. You know, when I think of cancer, I say to myself, I had some family members who died of cancer and this and that, the other thing. And to think all the money this country has, I find it hard to believe that they can't cure cancer. They come up with pills every day that could keep you alive for 20 years, but they can't cure you.
Or
so I look at this
to show you. Just to make
you know what I mean? So I look at it as, that's the scary part. Is this going to be something that, being that, I'm 45 now. So is it going to be something I'm going to take to my grave? Well, is this something that I'm going to take to my grave and say another 45 years, hopefully, that they're still fighting this war on terrorism because it's just redundant of what we've seen with the drug trade as well?
Wow.
Armando, you were about to weigh in.
Well, I was just agreeing. I agree fully. There's large amounts of money. That's bottom line. You're not gonna control, and you're not gonna be able to control it. It's when that amount of money, like you said, millions and billions of dollars, you're not gonna be able to control that in any way possible.
One thing that was brought up in this is that you were talking about these little alliances, these loose alliances where people trade experts back and forth to help one another out. And I can't help but think that when I was a kid, I often thought that, everybody was pretty much a nice person. Everybody was pretty much, fair and even-minded. And I can't help but think that some of these poor folks that are working in the in these trades, in their minds, they probably think they're pretty good folks, too. They don't probably see what they're doing as anything wrong other than making a living and what have you. But you combine it all together, and you've got a pretty dangerous cabal going on there.
Yeah. I was a pilot for a drug cartel, bad guy undercover for about a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
When I was loaned out to another agency for that. And I'll tell you, those people view themselves as good people. And I became good friends with some of them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, don't get me wrong. There was a couple that were just out and out evil. There was a guy.
Well, we've got that in broadcasting too.
Yeah. there was a guy. He was in it because they have a thing in the South called plomo o plata, which is Spanish for, you know, lead or silver. It's, you know, we'll pay you a lot of money if you do this for us, and if you don't do this for us, we'll kill your family. And so this guy became,
well, the rules are pretty simple.
Yeah. And so this guy, knowing that his family would be killed if he didn't fly for this drug cartel, because he was a very experienced pilot in this certain type of airplane. And I became very good friends with him. And he is rotting in a Jamaican jail and will continue to do so for about 25 more years. And it's sad because, you know, given his situation, I probably would do the same thing to save my family.
Wow.
Ugly, ugly, ugly. That's all I have to say on it. I'll tell you what, why don't we regroup and go to one of those infamous commercial breaks, except, of course, my commercial breaks are not like anyone else's. I want to give our listeners a chance to hear from the wonderful panel that we have about the things, the projects that they have going. Andrew, I'm going to start with you. I received the final edit of Surviving the Mob yesterday. As,
like that.
As I understand it, it streets on May 3rd. Can you tell us a little bit about it and where people can find it?
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about it. It basically gives a little storyline about my life in a nutshell. The video is about an hour and a half, and it touches on a lot of things. And what I tried to do with the film was, you know, throughout my life, I lost a lot of family and friends to violence, you know, organized crime violence. And what I wanted to do was, after I became a government witness in 97, and I was in prison for a few years, I decided, you know I'm not going to change the world with my message, but if I could touch some kid who's on a fence, there's a guy right now as we speak, Simon, he's in a jail cell, his back's to the wall. He just found out that this life that I lived is not what he thought it was. He knows that he's been spoon-fed lies his whole life. So if he could watch my movie or read my book, maybe he makes the positive change. He makes the decision that's going to save his life, get him back home to see his family. You know, and like I said, that's what the message is. And I'm trying to reach out to kids in that aspect. And I travel around now and I make speeches, and this is a part of it. And hopefully, you know, everybody will enjoy it because I share my personal stories, things that I did. I put it all out there. My life's an open book, so to speak, at this point, literally. And
right.
I'm just hoping I can get some positive feedback from people that might find themselves in the same situation as I was.
That's
okay,
awesome.
And
you for that.
And it is going to be on Amazon.
Yes, it'll be on Amazon on May 3rd. You can get it on Amazon.com. And me and Dennis Griffin have a book coming out on the same title, Surviving the Mob. It'll be on e-books and on the iPads and that stuff over the summer. But it comes out into the bookstores. We're hoping for an earliest release as October, November, the latest.
Well,
and,
I will be putting up a review of the DVD early next week.
Okay.
So hopefully lots of people will want to rush out and buy it. Do you have a website that?
Yeah, they could go to the website. It's survivingthemob.com, one word, survivingthemob.com, or they could find it on the production company's end of it, tworealproductions.com, number two, realproductions.com, and it'll give a whole synopsis of everything. And I found doing the film, it was very emotional for me. It really was, because it brought back a lot of old feelings, and I didn't expect it to be. I thought I was just going to go through this program talking, and, you know, next thing I know, I found my whole attitude had started to change as it got to the end, as you've seen, Simon. I went from 0 to 60 in 3.5 seconds, and hopefully people understand that it still affects. It's got a long-lasting effect, these things. You can never walk away from this. All you could do is learn from it, and you always deal with those scars one way or another.
Right. And I can assure everyone that's listening, this is a DVD that you will want to watch. And it's shocking. I think that's the best way to describe it. And I just can't wait for the book.
Yeah, Dennis is a very good writer, and working with Dennis has been a privilege for me. I mean, he knows his stuff, and I could tell Dennis something, and I could ramble on, and Dennis will have it down on print the next morning, and I'm shocked sometimes. You know?
And in fact, on that subject, Denny, obviously you and Andrew are busily beavering away on this book. Plus, you have several others in print, particularly the biography of Frank Collada. Where can people find your books, and where can people find you?
All my books are available on Amazon, and also there's links from my website, which is dennisngriffin.com. And people can find me through the website. You can send me emails or contact me. And I'm currently in Las Vegas, Nevada. And we have several projects. Obviously, I'm very excited about Andrew's book, Surviving the Mob, and of course, the documentary that's coming out. And it was funny the way things worked. The Collada biography that I co-authored with Frank resulted in the Surviving the Mob deal, because when Andrew was looking for someone to help him with the book, he Googled my name and found out that I had been previously done a book with a witness protection guy. And I always like to use the term when I'm talking about this is made my bones, so to speak, in the writing business with doing mob-related books. So, you know, I never thought of that when I was doing Collada, that things have an impact that you don't really expect down the line, but it worked out very well.
And I can recommend all of Denny's books. Denny, don't you also have a TV project and a couple of other projects in the works?
Yes, I do, as a matter of fact. Your memory's better than mine, Simon. We've got we put together a pilot for a TV show called Crime Wire. And what we're going to be doing on that program is profiling cold case homicides, current unsolved homicides, domestic violence issues, and we're going to be taking a look at something I find very troublesome. Are cases that are determined, ruled to be accident or suicide, the death cases, when there is credible evidence that they may have been homicides. And the families of these individuals who are deceased, what they have to go through trying to get justice, trying to get a police agency to take a second look, trying to get a coroner's office or medical examiner's office to change the death certificate from accident or suicide to at least undetermined, if not homicide. And I wasn't aware of it previously, but that is very critical. It of course, can affect life insurance payments, for example, on a suicide issue. But there are support groups and there are various agencies that will help victims, families of homicide, to get justice. It will help them even get money for funerals. And there's all kinds of things out there. But if that death certificate says accident or suicide and these benefits or services are only for homicide victim families, they're precluded from access. And the authorities tell them, well, look, we'd consider changing the death certificate at the ME's office or the coroner's, but it's up to you, family, to bring us information. In other words, you've got to do your own investigation. The police aren't going to do it. We've already done ours. We've closed it out as an accident or suicide. So you hire your own private investigators. You hire your own attorneys. You hire your own crime scene people. You get your independent pathologist. I mean, and a lot of people don't have the financial or emotional wherewithal to do that. And we're going to profile some of those cases, too, and try to bring attention to those issues. If we're real lucky, maybe we'll end up getting the case actually solved, but we at least want to bring it to the public's attention and see if we can make a difference.
Do you have any guesstimate as to when it might be hitting a TV screen near us?
Well, we're going. We currently have the trailer of the first episode that we filmed is out there now. It's just being circulated for consideration. But we are going to take a three-step approach. The first one is we're going to have a debut Blog Talk radio show on May 4th. That will be basically an introductory show where the principals that are involved in the project will give an indication and a synopsis of what the project is about. Then we'll start profiling actual cases. We have a large volume of cases already that are waiting. We haven't even solicited cases yet. These are people have heard about us and are submitting. We're also going to have a crimewiresite.com. That's www.crimewiresite.com. And that is currently up, but it's not. We're still adding to it. We hope to have it pretty much operating May 1st. Profiling cases on the radio, the Blog Talk show, and on the website, and then eventually TV show. So we'll be starting very soon and with the website information.
That's great. Armando, you have two books in print, and I believe a third is in the works. Tell us a thumbnail sketch about your books, where people can find them, and where people can find you.
Okay, you can find my books pretty much anywhere. Most importantly, Amazon. You don't have to actually go out anywhere. The first book is What You're Turning Me Into, and my recent book is Cocaine Memoirs, a novel. They're both fictional works, but like you said, they do shadow a lot of my life, and they're basically about recovery and redemption, trying to come to terms with your past in order to make ways for your future, trying to recover from drug addiction. Pretty much a lot of what I've experienced. As far as future projects, yeah, I have a book that's in the works. I have five children, so it kind of like gets paused a lot. And being that I'm a, like, pretty much an emotional writer, and I tend to write as I'm feeling at the moment, the book tends to take a lot of turns and twists that I have to go back. So it takes a lot of time for me to actually put that together. And but me and my good friend Josh Russ, he's also a writer, we're trying to incorporate the both of the books into a screenplay. And we have a few connections that can get us there. We're both film majors, so we're trying to incorporate that and trying to get it out there as far as that's concerned. And that's pretty much it. Most of the time, just with my children.
Do you have a website?
Yes, you can go to cocainememoirsanovel.wordpress.com. There, that'll pretty much take you to all my other sites and where you can find and buy the books, and it's got excerpts of the books and so forth.
And Dave, you also have two books out. Tell us a little bit about them and where people can find you, and most importantly of all, where people can buy them.
Well, my first book is How to Get a Job in the War on Terrorism. And I wrote that because I enjoy my job. I make a six-figure income, and I have 4 to 6 months a year off. and I feel like it's a job where we are making a difference where we are. We're making history. I get to pal around with station chiefs and ambassadors, with Delta Force guys and SEALs and all kinds of good stuff like that. And in fact, many times on the way back from a mission, my co-pilot will say to me, you know, they pay us to do this. So I
think it would be fair to say that this book is not a how-to guide to get a job as an airport screener.
No. It's a private military contractor. It helps to, if you've been in one of the elite forces, but that's not a prerequisite. I've seen people that come right out of a civilian world and fit in. You've got to have a little different attitude about living conditions. But my book sets out mostly a description of the industry, why the industry will continue to grow, how to network in, because you'll never get in by sending in a resume, how to get the interview, and what the main factors that the people are looking for, the secret things that guys will never tell you that are the reasons that they hire people. The other book that I've got is a fiction. It's pure entertainment. It's military adventure set in Africa, and it looks at the mixture of politics and religion, power, lust, and greed that is the modern-day Africa. And it's a small-time dictator that's taken over a mining area that mines a strategic mineral that the U.S. and some multinational corporations want those mines back and hire some mercenaries that are managed by some U.S. government people to mount a war against this guy, and how the mercenary pilot that is shot down has to team up with a missionary to escape after an assassin changes the whole concept.
And do you have a website?
www.dallanjohnson.com. D, like Delta, A-L-A-N, Johnson.com.
And I can recommend both of these books, even though most of us don't want to become private military contractors and have people shoot at us.
Oh, no, I want to sign up.
Do you guys take
formal mobsters?
I've got to say something here. I've got a lot of friends that are dead, a lot, and they were accountants, they were truck drivers, they were air traffic controllers, and they're all dead. The guys I fly with are all alive. So, you know, that stress is a killer.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my. But what I was going to say was, even though, you know, most of us probably don't want to take up the life of being a private military contractor, What I enjoyed about the book was it's really two books. You know, one is a how-to guide and, you know, who to talk to, what to do, and how to do it. But I love the personal anecdotes that you included. I mean, they are priceless.
Well, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. TJ, you and I seem to be the only ones that don't have any books. I mean, I guess we're going to have to put our heads together one of these days.
The Oxy Memoirs.
Actually, TJ, you and I are pretty... Oh, I think I might just have lost TJ. He's feeling bad because he doesn't have a book. Okay, let's go back to illicit street drugs. Not so much the ones that require importation by whatever means, but lab drugs. What can be done to control them? I mean, meth has become a huge, huge problem, as are many of the other street drugs. Who wants to field that one? Denny?
Yes, Simon.
What can we do about lab drugs?
Pardon me?
What can we do about illegal lab-produced drugs, meth, and things like that?
Well, right near where I live, these budget suite type units, and where you can rent by the month or whatever, and say that about 50% of the time, it's when I'm going somewhere by these various units, the parking lots generally have 3 or 4 police cars in them. They're blocked off, and they're raiding a meth lab that operates in one of these. In one of these, and it's. I mean, it keeps the this metro here pretty busy trying to keep. My sense is that we're not leaning on these operations. They're there all the time. It's a daily occurrence. And I don't really know. I wish I had an answer. I don't know what to get an upper hand on this. I mean, they're busting them as they come or learn about them. They're hauling the people into jail. I think that in some cases, and I realize that with the jail overcrowding and so forth, there's a big issue about the population and keeping the more dangerous, violent criminals locked up and not necessarily the nonviolent people. I understand that. But I've read and heard a lot of these people arrested are just given a pass. And is that right? You know, I mean, you got to look at the overall situation. Everybody behind bars, probably not. And I just don't know where it's going to go. I only wish I did. I would love to think I could help solve the problem, but I don't have the answers.
Andrew, do you have any thoughts on the home-cooked drugs that are flooding the market?
Years ago, it used to be pills that were, you know, made in the labs and everything like that. I don't know too much about methamphetamine, but I could tell you one thing. You know, I mean, as far as fighting it, it has a very it goes back to it again. It has a very big profit margin. And what this is, a gentleman said previously earlier that he lived in an area which was rural. So what happens is if these guys live in these rural areas and there's not really much work and there's not really much for them to do as far as, you know, job descriptions, if, you know, if they don't have a skill or anything like that, what do these guys do? But they live in these rural areas, so it makes it easy for them to hide what they're doing. So now they have a big project. Profit margin with the methamphetamine, and they live in a, you know, on a farm area, or their nearest neighbor is a mile or two away, you know, they feel as though that, you know, nobody's watching. And if nobody's watching, how do you prevent that? You know, it's very hard to prevent. This seems to be like the new craze, but like somebody said earlier, it eats you from the inside out almost immediately. And I was watching that TV show not too long ago, Intervention, and one of the people on that Intervention show was saying how the high from it was like so intense that they found themselves that they couldn't, there was no way to warn it off, like they couldn't fight the demons, they just gave up completely to this drug. I don't know how they would fight it, but it's a dirty, dirty drug, you know, I mean, there's no clean or dirty drug, so to speak, but when you think about what it does to a person, how it deteriorates their health, you know, just being around the chemicals and being, you know, near it could affect, you know, children or whatever the case may be. You know, you have all these fires and explosions behind it. I mean, I don't know. I mean, like, it's not something that I've ever was involved in or have top knowledge of. I was away with a few guys who were meth dealers, and they said that, you know, the profit margin was huge.
Oh, man.
That's all I know. That's all I know as far as that's concerned.
Armando, I know that your books mainly talk about cocaine, but that there are references to, you know, meth and some of these other lab-produced products. You know, is there a way to control the lab-produced drugs?
I don't know much about meth. I can't really elaborate much as far as meth or the addict or anything about it. I haven't known many people. I haven't really come across that. I did grow up in Miami, which, you know, back then was cocaine capital of the world. I don't think that there's, I keep going back to the same thing I was saying and Andrew was saying. Once there's that much money involved, I mean, you can shut down the labs, you can bust the dealers, you can lock up the addicts. At the end of the day, you're going to have to go back tomorrow and do the same thing because another one's popped up. There's, to me, no way around it except rounding up, treating the addicts. I don't know. I'm finding some kind of intervention to cut the drug dealer's head off versus letting them grow another one.
Okay. Dave, I'm going to ask you the question. Where does the intervention need to come? Do we need to cut it off at the source, or do we need to cut it off at the supply route, or do we just need to make the need of the user go away? And I don't know how we'd achieve that.
Well, the simple answer to that is yes. But, you know, you have to do all three. And we talked, one of the guys said earlier that, you know, we've got to fight right now this losing battle until we get the next generation. And that is so true that, you know, in objective terms, our war is an abject failure. But we've got to, for morality purposes, still try to inhibit the importation and use. But the secret is changing our culture. I've lived in cultures overseas that produce these drugs but never use them. There was no temptation in that culture. They had family, they had activities, they had religion, they had things that filled their heart. And you've got to find, you can't just pull something away from someone without replacing it. And if you replace that with whatever, you know, those of us on this phone call, we have something that fills our life, our families, our children, our belief systems, whatever that is, we've got to have something to fill that void in people, an ambition, an art, whatever.
Mm. Okay, I'm going to change the subject slightly. I was watching, I believe it was CNN, but it could have been one of the other stations, and that there's talk about legalizing marijuana in California. In fact, it's going to be on the ballot in November, and I followed that up by doing some Googling around. I came across this really curious article. Not everyone's in favor of this legalization. I believe it's in the San Mateo area that there's a huge amount of illegal marijuana grow ops, and they really feel that this is going to damage the economy, the local economy. It's going to be legal, it's going to be taxed, and their edge is gone. So I guess I'm going back to the idea of there being a gray economy here. What do you think about legalizing drugs, Dave?
Well, first of all, if we could get rid of the shadow economy, it would be such a boon for our real economy. People would stop spending money on these drugs and start spending money on things that would build jobs for other people. Just like when we you know, people said, well, when we get rid of the railroads, you know, the whole economy will collapse, and that's not what happened. Our economy grew. But the moral obligations that if we legalize drugs and our whole society becomes more turned on all the time, then we lose our inhibitions, we lose some of our dignity, our sobriety, our purpose, and our productivity. And that's, I think, an insidious consequence of legalizing drugs.
Andrew, do you think we should legalize them?
No, because I look at it this way. If you legalize the drugs, now you're talking about tax on the drugs. Now, I happen to be back a few years back, I was in the marijuana business. And I could tell you that if I was a drug dealer at that today's day and age, and this is what I was doing, I would have to go to a different drug because now you have to pay tax on it. There's going to be all these restrictions. And I believe that once, if it is, becomes a legal substance, I believe the government's going to control it. They're going to make all the money from it. And a guy who, there'll be very few personal dealers in my eyes. You know, big money people, yes. People who have big money, who can do it. But there won't be no more average guys doing it. And what it would do is, I think, he was just talking about the shadow economy. People who are in the street, who are trying to earn, that's going to hurt them. That'll hurt the areas and where they live and the people who are used to, you know, getting those untaxed dollars out there. And now everything they're going to have to go through is going to have to be paid. Something's going to have to be paid to the government. And who knows what kind of restrictions. I mean, you'd have to really see what that whole law would, when it passes, what it entails. I mean, you know, from the street perspective of it, I would move on.
In this article, or maybe it was a separate article that I read, and I have not researched it, so I don't know if it's true, but in the light of the possibility of it being legalized, at least one major tobacco company has taken the steps of starting the trademark process on some of the particular brands of marijuana. Can you...
Now you're talking about big business.
Oh, we're talking very big business.
Yeah, now you're talking about really, really big business now. And who's going to make that kind of money in the big business? You got giants like the tobacco industry who got tons and tons of money, and the government. And when they control it, it might be good for the whole process of the United States as a whole. In other words, if that money's going to be used to go towards, you know, helping communities and do certain things like that, but if it's just going to be run as a business, there's not going to be any good, there's not going to be any good ending with that.
But they'll be using it to bail out the banks.
Well, it's amazing.
Denny, what's your theory on this California idea?
I don't have just blind faith and confidence in anything that the government runs. They do some good things and so forth, but you can look and find all kinds of problems with government-controlled programs. So turning something with the money potential of this drug issue, turning this over to the control of the government or other big business, I have a lot of concerns about that. So I'm personally opposed to it.
Dave, I'm sure you are opposed as well.
Yeah, the history of legalization of these kind of things, you know, I'm gonna heap in some sort of unrelated stuff, but of drugs and prostitution has never shown to be a good thing for society. The Netherlands is the example that everyone uses, but the Netherlands has become a much coarser society now, with addicts that hang out in the parks and prostitutes that are open all the time, and getting rid of the stigma or the crime of prostitution has not stopped women from being forced against their will into the slave trade, which is a big part of my business also. We don't talk about very often, but just like I think it was Armando was saying, that when you make something legal, the bad guys have got to move into something else, and usually it's something worse.
Armando, do you think California is sensible by putting this on the ballot?
Well, my opinion on that is, I was in California not too long ago. I spent some time in San Diego, great place. They might as well legalize it. I mean, it's pretty much legal there anywhere you go. I mean, in L.A., they got vending machines where you can, you know, put in your money and push a button and your pot comes out. I mean, it's already pretty much legal. And it's 89 to 90% of their economy. So, I mean, their prison system, all that's going to go is there is going to relieve some pressure because it's probably full of stoners. And it's going to have some space for some real criminals to actually be punished for their crimes versus someone who's just got caught with a quarter of weed.
Okay, we're...
Hey, Simon.
Yes.
No, I look away. One more. I got one more thing to say about it. No, I was thinking about... I'm thinking about the way the California economy is. Now, I've been hearing for the last 2 or 3 years that the California economy is destroyed, that they were sending out IOUs not too long ago to the people when they had to pay taxes or something. And I would think that maybe they're pushing for it now because they see an outlet to relieve the state of some sort of deficits that they're in. I mean, I'm looking at it from that aspect of it. Maybe they're pushing for that, not so much as to, you know, because there's a problem with the drug and they just want to control it, but more or less it's going to help them, the state, financially. I don't know, but...
Well, I'm in agreement with you. I mean, that this is all about the money.
Yeah, exactly. And all you've been hearing is that California is hurting for money, you know, and that, you know, they have a tremendous deficit. And then I don't know how long ago it was. A few years ago, the thing with the IOUs, with the people who are trying to pay their taxes, who got tax money coming back. But I would assume that that's what they're going to use it for, first and foremost.
Right.
Not only that, but once their economy does, if it does tend to go up or so forth, it's just going to catch on, and all the other states are just going to start to follow lead.
Yeah. I agree.
To me, it's wrong. I personally don't have a problem with marijuana. However, I used to work in an environment where drugs were very prevalent, the homeless shelter, and we would have very, very serious addicts, and some of them ended up dead addicts. And what you tended to find was that when you talked to a serious addict, they got their start with marijuana. Now, it's an argument that has been made many, many times. You know, does marijuana lead to stronger stuff? Not necessarily, but sometimes it does. So, you know, should we legalize marijuana in the knowledge that only a small percentage of people will go on to other drugs, or what is that percentage? I mean, I don't have a clue.
In percentages, I wouldn't say, but I wouldn't say that it leads to other things, but it gives opportunity for other things. In other words, it doesn't necessarily walk you down that path, but that opportunity will be there. And if it goes according to your own personality, or, you know, your own willpower. Like you go and you know, smoke a pot with your friends in a schoolyard and this, that, the other thing, and it seems to be a pretty innocent thing to you, you know. And then all of a sudden, next day or month later, you go to that schoolyard and your friend don't have marijuana, but he has something else. Now that's where your decision falls in.
Right.
You know, and that's where the problem lies. It opens the door to you know, a wide range of things. Do they lead to them? I think that's up to the individual if it leads to it.
Right.
But for the most part, it does open other doors.
Okay,
we're
running a little short on the clock here. What I would like to do is go around the table and get everyone's parting thoughts. Unfortunately, we lost TJ, but I will call him after the program and include his thoughts in my text wrap-up. But let's start with you, Armando. What do you make of today's program subject we've been talking about?
I like to say a couple things. A couple of them, just to go off the subject real quick, I like to say happy birthday to my dad. He's 64 today. And he's
happy birthday.
And he's listening to the show, so I want to definitely say that. I also want to say, besides every successful man, there's a successful woman, and I love my wife. I want to say that. And also, as far as the whole drug thing goes, I'm going to stick to my guns and say it becomes an education factor with our children. If we put our children in the forefront without the education and the knowledge of these drugs, then they're going to do these drugs. But if we teach them and we shelter them, I'm not going to say shelter them, but if we enforce this whole entire culture on them and we let them know that, you know, the values and the not values from it, and we teach them the right from wrong, we at least eliminate an 80% factor that they're going to do this. And like Andrew said, they're going to be at the, you know, playground doing this and that. But if, you know, they're offered this and they're offered that, and if in the back of their mind they can say, well, my dad told me this, or he showed me this, or my mom, you know what I mean, she installed this in me, they will walk away from it.
I sincerely hope that a child would. David, I want to get your thoughts. This is the first time you've taken part in one of these food fights. What's your parting thoughts?
Our culture is a culture of impatience, and that's one of the reasons America has prospered so. But in this battle, we run out of patience too soon. This drug war may need to go on for several generations, that we could change our culture and instill in our children that sense of worth and fill them with a sense of purpose and a mission in life that would drive out that emptiness that causes them to seek out escapism. And to my fellow countrymen is, have patience. The drug war can be won, but it cannot be won this week.
Right. What I'm hearing is education.
And more than education, this sense of purpose, this that I'm going to be a doctor, these things that our forefathers seem to have, this ambition, this desire to be something greater than yourself, to be an author, to be a race driver, whatever that thing is that fills you with a purpose in life.
I like that.
Yes, sir.
Denny, give us your words of wisdom.
I think, well, first let me extend also my birthday wishes to Armando's dad. Happy birthday. And my feeling is this. I think David and Armando expressed the education and the patience and so forth. And I agree with that. And this is a war on drugs. And I've never been a big advocate of surrender. And I don't advocate that here. I think the battle must go on. And like David says, we can win. It's a matter of patience. It's a matter of not giving up. It's a matter of keeping going and do what we have to do through education, through enforcement, and so forth until we bring this to a successful conclusion. If it takes many years, then that's what it's going to do. But I don't think we should lose sight of the final goal.
And Andrew, your parting thoughts.
Well, my parting thoughts on the whole scenario, you know, they're a mirror image to what everybody else has been saying. You know, education starts in the home. You know, values start in the home. But it doesn't, you know, I know a lot of good guys throughout my life who turned to drugs and they had great families, you know, and you don't know why they went to drugs or what that empty feeling was that they were looking for or whatever it was. You know, I think a lot of it is, you know, instilling good instincts in your children, and it's also a little luck. You know, it's a little luck.
Yeah, luck is definitely involved.
Yeah, and as far as the war on drugs, I would say this. You got well-educated guys on both sides of the fence, and it's a chess match. And it's definitely a long game. It's not something that he said is going to be done next week. We could have, my children's children could be having this conversation so many years from now. And like I said, it's just, you know, you have intelligent people on both sides. That side trying to stay alive and, you know, get over on their drug business. And then you have this side that's trying to stop them. And they're going to be, you know, new inventions to get things done. And law enforcement's going to have to come up with new tools to prevent that. It's always going to change. Every day it changes. And as it changes, they have to make the accommodations for the change. They have to adapt. And that's why it's a long-running war. I agree.
I want to thank everyone that took part in the program today. It really has been a very illuminating discussion. And, you know, you all come from such diverse backgrounds, careers even. Great. And I do hope that in the future we can reconvene and talk some more. Till next time, this is Simon Barrett for Blogger News Network, wishing everyone a great Saturday, and thank you to my very special panel. Have a great day, everyone. Goodbye.
Thank you, sir.
See you later, Simon.